Sudan's Darfur region has dealt with war and trauma going back decades. Troubling signs of war crimes are emerging again.
If this oft-repeated phrase of never again is to mean anything, it must mean something here and now.
Also ahead, the downsides of building more clean energy in Spain.
Entonces sería un paraguas gigantesco.
This farmer says he won't cut down his olive trees to make room for solar panels, no matter how much money he's offered. Plus, if you go for a dip in the ocean this summer, it might feel nice, but all those warm spots are worrying climate scientists.
Places like the North Atlantic, around the United Kingdom, Western Indian Ocean, Equatorial Pacific, Northeast Pacific, conditions are fairly widespread. There are marine heat waves all over the globe right now.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler, in for Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us. For 3 months, fighting in Sudan has raged between the National Army and a rival militia known as the Rapid Support Forces. More than 3 million people have been displaced. The situation is especially bad in Sudan's Darfur region, and new evidence is emerging of possible war crimes. As The World's Halima Gakhandi reports, it's a place where violence goes back many years.
In the early 2000s, violence against ethnic African tribes in Sudan's Darfur region led the U.S. to call it a genocide. Now people are warning history could repeat itself. Letitia Bader is with Human Rights Watch.
The trends of abuse we're seeing now, there is a chilling echo of what we were seeing in the early conflict in Darfur 20 years ago.
This week, Human Rights Watch released a report on the destruction of a town called Misteri in western Darfur. They spoke with witnesses who had escaped to neighboring Chad, who said the Rapid Support Forces, one of the main antagonists in this broader conflict, attacked the town along with local Arab militias, killing civilians.
Now, this is a town which is predominantly ethnic Masalit, and it was very clear that they were targeting the ethnic Masalit male population.
Masalit is one of the ethnic African tribes in Darfur. The RSF and Arab militias also destroyed this town of around 46,000 people.
They were also more broadly attacking civilians and civilian infrastructure. What we saw in the course of the day was that they were looting people's personal objects, livestock, and then they basically burnt the town to the ground.
Letitia Bader says she is concerned the current nationwide conflict is creating an opportunity for the RSF and Arab militias to commit more widespread abuses in Darfur. The situation has caused many African tribes to fear there is an effort to permanently displace them.
This is something that has been vocalized as a political agenda by many of the Arab community leaders, but we've also seen very concretely this being visibly at the heart of the attacks we've been seeing for the last few years.
This is the fear that many Darfuris hold, including Adam Musa Ishage of the Darfur Network for Human Rights. He grew up in Al-Ganina, the capital of West Darfur.
This is, it's going to change, the demography of the states and the demography of the civilian of the African community inside the Darfur region.
He said the international community needs to step up to stop what he calls a genocide. His organization has been monitoring the human rights violations in Darfur.
If this situation is still going on like this, soon or later, even, the African tribes, they can lose their identity and they can lose everything, inside the Darfur region.
On Thursday, the United Nations said a mass grave was found in Darfur containing the remains of 87 people. Karim Khan, the prosecutor at the International Criminal Court, spoke to the UN Security Council yesterday. He urged the international community to protect the people of Darfur.
If this oft-repeated phrase of never again is to mean anything, it must mean something here and now for the people of Darfur that have lived with this uncertainty and pain and the scars of conflict for almost 2 decades.
He said the ICC has started investigating recent allegations of war crimes in Sudan's Darfur region. For The World, I'm Halima Gakhandi in Nairobi.
Hollywood actors have now joined screenwriters in going on strike. It's the first joint strike in more than six decades. This story is centered in California, but it has impacts on filmmaking across the globe. And we've asked Miranda Banks to tell us about those. She's an associate professor of film, television, and media studies at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, and the author of a book about the Writers Guild called The Writers. Miranda, let's start with the basics here. What's the beef that the writers and actors have with Hollywood right now?
During any negotiation, there's always compensation on the table. But there are a number of things that have shifted in the industry that have been kind of created existential crises. Streaming and how that's changed how television shows and movies are distributed, residuals from those areas, and the compensation. And then separately, the biggest issue is artificial intelligence and where and how that might change the careers of actors and writers.
So productions are continuing in some cases abroad, but the strikes here might actually have the impact of bringing production to a halt abroad if actors are members of the same union. Is that right?
For example, you've got Kate Winslet, you know, who's making something in Croatia. She's still going to be on a SAG-AFTRA contract.
Miranda, are there specific countries or regions across the globe that will be especially impacted by work stoppages, places that are, you know, especially attractive to filmmakers?
I think of Ireland as one of those places. You know, Ireland has done an astonishingly large amount of building of studios and sets with the expectation that a lot of production is going there. So I think in the short term, it's not going to be significant. But if these strikes last for a few more months, then we're really looking at serious challenges.
What about any workforce or union issues outside of the U.S. with foreign writers or actors? Are any striking in solidarity with U.S. writers and actors, or is there any overlap in the issues that they face?
No other groups are striking in solidarity, but they are on Twitter and on their websites as individuals and as organizations expressing their solidarity. They are significant. At the beginning of the Writers Guild strike, there were these global conversations about the meaning of what these writers are getting in the U.S. and how Hollywood is an epicenter. What happens here really resonates across the globe, and it sets decisions that are made in other countries and with other union and labor structures around what does compensation look like for people across the globe.
And what about funding? Is the U.S. a major source of capital for filmmaking, not just here, but all around the world?
Oh, yes. You know, Hollywood doesn't make the most films these days, that's India, and it doesn't make the most television series. I believe that's China. But what Hollywood does do is that they regularly spend the most amount of money on production, and they make the most revenue. And much of that production is happening outside of Hollywood. So the impact on production across the globe is significant, with two of the major unions on strike together. We are a voracious audience, and so it is quite likely that we're going to be looking all over the globe for whatever it is that we want to watch come a month or two, or if this goes longer, unfortunately, 3 months down the road.
So potential economic impact to those locations and the sort of local industry there.
Well, you know, one other frame that's really interesting is not just what is shooting, but also the number of major film festivals that are coming up. And for many actors and, you know, writers, creators, they are not interested in going to these festivals and putting in that time on the red carpet or with the press talking about the films or series that they're working on. So most notably, we've got two big film festivals coming up. The Venice Film Festival comes at the end of August, and then the Toronto International Film Festival will happen in early September. And those will be significantly impacted if the strikes don't end before then.
This is all fascinating. Miranda Banks is an associate professor of film, television, and media studies at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles and author of a book about the American Writers Guild called The Writers. Miranda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The ruble is not doing very well. The Russian currency has been in a free fall. Last week, it reached its lowest point against the U.S. dollar since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine began. The World's Daniel Offman reports.
Early last year, just after Russian tanks started rolling into Ukraine, the response from a whole host of nations came quickly.
The U.S., Canada, and European allies are cutting off key Russian banks from the SWIFT global banking system. The move is seen as the harshest financial sanction imposed so far on Russia.
At the time, it felt like Russia's economy was suddenly in big trouble.
The sanctions from the West are already having a major impact on Russia's economy. The Russian ruble plummeted against the dollar today, dropping 30%.
Russian citizens flocked to ATMs hoping to withdraw their money, fearing that the country would face cash shortages. But then, going into April of last year, the ruble seemed to bounce back. Rachel Ziemba follows sanctions and the Russian economy at the Center for New American Security.
They hiked interest rates sharply, and they also imposed capital controls. They made it very difficult for people to take money out of the country, plus the fact that Russia continued to sell oil and gas helped to stabilize Russia's currency.
So in the face of sanctions, the Russian economy was staying afloat. This continues to be something that the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, likes to talk about.
У России насыщенная и весьма амбициозная экономическая повестка.
Speaking last month in St. Petersburg, Putin said that Russia's economy continues to be robust and ambitious. He acknowledged difficulties and problems encountered by Russia, but said that they're making Russia's economy stronger. But that positive spin on the sanctions can't paper over certain realities.
Сейчас наступил тот момент, когда кровь может пролиться.
Last month's attempted mutiny by Wagner mercenary fighters led by Yevgeny Prigozhin brought a level of political uncertainty that Putin had never dealt with. And that's when the ruble started tanking at a faster rate. Here's Rachel Ziemba again.
With currencies, it's always that precipitous nature of a decline that's, you know, more concerning. We have heard evidence suggest that Russians did accelerate their pulling of assets outside of the banking system.
According to the country's central bank, Russians withdrew 100 billion rubles, that's more than $1 billion, from banks over the course of just a few days during the panic of the Prigozhin mutiny. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov tried to downplay these concerns last week, saying there is no question of economic stability here. That interpretation was echoed on Russian state TV.
Ничего драматического-то не происходит. То есть, конечно, доля...
TV presenter Yevgeny Popov declared, "Nothing dramatic is happening here," referring to the plunging ruble. He then said that this is a natural process of Russia's economy transitioning from Western markets to the East. Rachel Ziemba says that process is taking place.
Much of Russia's oil goes to India and China, other emerging markets. So when we look at it, both Russia's supplies and the commodities Russia sells are going to a different set of countries than they were 2 years ago.
And that's a direct result of economic sanctions imposed against Russia. But the question remains, are the sanctions strong enough to undercut Russia's economy and have a real impact on Russia's war in Ukraine?
This is a case where the restrictive tools can only do so much, especially where, as a global economy, we still rely on Russian oil and gas. And I think it's very difficult for a country that is as committed to this sort of military action, it's very difficult to sway them just on economic terms.
The U.S., along with other G7 countries, have tried implementing an oil price cap in order to limit Russia's oil revenues. But it's still unclear how well that's being enforced. Ultimately, Rachel Ziemba says that Ukraine's fate will not just depend on the success of economic sanctions against Russia. It will have a lot more to do with what happens on the battlefield in Ukraine. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
You're with The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. You're listening to The World. 96-degree water. That's approaching hot tub temperatures, and it's how hot the ocean is off the coast of Florida right now. There's an unprecedented marine heat wave there, and it's one of just many places globally plagued by high ocean temperatures this summer. For more, we turn to Dylan Amaya. He's a researcher at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Dylan, I understand that your research shows that some 40% of global ocean surface temperatures are currently high enough to qualify as in the heat wave territory. Have we seen something like this before?
No, just looking back at our record, going back to 1991, this is sort of the first time that we've seen global oceans experiencing marine heat waves across this much of the planet. As you said, we're at about 44% now, and our forecasts project that number to increase to as much as 50% by September or October of this year.
Now, we're in an El Nino year right now, right? Can you remind me of if or how that impacts this?
Yeah, typically we expect the planet just to be naturally warmer during El Nino years. That's exactly what we're seeing. But, you know, on top of that, we do have long-term warming trends associated with climate change, and that's sort of exacerbating these conditions as well.
Just how much do you see the fingerprints of climate change on these hot ocean temperatures?
We know that 90% of the excess heat associated with global warming is going into the ocean. Part of that manifests in these extremes. Currently, as I said, about 44% of the planet is covered in marine heat waves. But if we sort of account for those long-term warming trends, if we remove the effects of human-induced warming, then we might expect that number to be closer to 25%. So it's almost a doubling.
Wow. So twice as much of the world's oceans are in a marine heat wave right now because of climate change, you're saying?
Correct.
And this 44% is obviously a huge portion of the world's oceans. Are there specific places or temperature spikes that you're particularly worried about?
In particular, we're worried about what's going on in the North Atlantic. Obviously, really warm temperatures are an important fuel source for developing tropical storms. And we are in the thick of the tropical Atlantic hurricane season. So we're certainly keeping an eye on what's going on there. We're also interested in what's going on in the Northeast Pacific. There's been a pretty large marine heat wave sort of hanging out in the Gulf of Alaska, sort of offshore of the United States West Coast. And our forecasts project that to potentially move onshore as early as winter of this year and possibly into spring of next year. That's a big concern for us because the California current system has a lot of sensitive marine ecosystems that can respond pretty negatively to strong warming.
Can you tell me what some of those responses would be? What would happen to the marine life? It sounds like in sort of the medium term in the next several months.
Generally, marine heat waves can impact ecosystems sort of from the bottom up. So we know that marine heat waves can affect sort of foundational ecosystem species, things like seagrasses and kelp. And that sort of works its way up the food chain. It can affect, you know, all trophic levels up to whales. And so we know that marine heat waves end up costing billions of dollars in socioeconomic damages just by their impacts on ecosystems and fisheries.
So these are, as I said, medium-term implications. Is there anything happening right now that's more immediate, say coral bleaching or immediate marine life in peril?
Yeah, we're certainly concerned about what's going on in the Florida Keys and its potential impacts on corals, as you said. Temperatures around there are nearing hot tub temperatures in the upper or mid-90s, and corals really respond strongly to prolonged heat stress. They're very sensitive to crossing temperature thresholds. So if we see water temperatures rise above these sort of danger zones, these critical lines, and stay there for prolonged periods of time, then we'll see die-offs, we'll see bleaching events.
As you mentioned, your organization is predicting that by this fall, half of global oceans will be in a heat wave. What are the long-term implications of that beyond the current hurricane season, for example?
One sort of side effect of long-term warming is its impact on the distribution of different fisheries. Generally speaking, fisheries tend to move poleward as the globe continues to warm, as you know, critters are being displaced. Fishes are very strongly adapted to a certain temperature range within the waters that they have evolved to live in. And so they're chasing temperature. They're trying to find an ecosystem that is, you know, what they're used to. So they tend to move poleward as a result, trying to get to colder, higher latitudes.
You said that 90% of the world's excess heat has gone into the oceans. The oceans have been acting as this buffer that helps protect terrestrial ecosystems and us for a long time. Do you think that we're relying on the oceans too much to keep us safe?
Yeah, so I don't know if we should be relying on the ocean as much as we have been. I mean, the ocean is certainly taking up a ton of extra heat, and as a result, global warming hasn't been as severe as it otherwise would have been. You know, if we lived on a giant rock, you know, with zero oceans, the planet would be a lot warmer than it is. But we shouldn't rely on sort of the band-aid that the oceans have provided. We should be aware of what we're doing to our planet and not take for granted the fact that we have, you know, this big, beautiful blue ball that's throwing us a lifeline.
Dylan Amaya is a researcher at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. We've been talking about marine heat waves. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you very much for having me.
Don't tell this to the favorite birder in your life, but in some places, birds are seen as pests. They can be loud and leave unwelcome droppings. City planners and architects often put metal spikes on the sides of buildings to prevent nesting and perching. But as the world's Anna Kussmer reports, some of the birds have outsmarted us humans.
Biologist Auka Florian-Himstra is interested in the ways animals interact with the urban environment. From his perch at the Naturalis Biodiversity Center in the Netherlands, he always asks people to send him photos of nests with weird stuff in them.
And so this whole story just started with me receiving an email from someone who said, "You have to see what I'm seeing right now."
From a hospital window in Antwerp, Belgium, someone sent him a photo he could hardly believe.
And it was such a strange, big, beautiful, quirky nest.
Around 3 feet tall and wide.
And it consists of 1,500 sharp, nasty metal spikes. So it's really like a fortress, like a bunker for birds.
It was a magpie nest made with anti-bird spikes.
And magpies are used to make nests with thorny branches, so plants with spikes.
The magpies were using the anti-bird spikes as anti-bird spikes.
These magpies actually used the bird spikes in the same way that they were intended to be used by us, to ward off other birds.
As Himstra continued to investigate, he learned that other related birds, like crows, were doing the same thing in Scotland and the Netherlands.
More and more of these anti-bird spike nests were popping up on the map.
Himstra says he's used to seeing birds use strange things in their nests. He's seen them use barbed wire, COVID masks, even knitting needles. But there's something almost poetic about birds using anti-bird materials.
So nice to see some of these rebellious birds actually trying to fight back.
Now that he's done the research, Himstra says he's noticed just how many spikes cover so many city buildings.
Everywhere, suddenly, you see them. And it really annoys me so much as a biologist that we're trying so hard to fight our urban biodiversity.
It's the perfect revenge, he says, that the birds are using the anti-bird spikes to make nests, to make more birds. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
More stories from around the globe are still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. In Egypt, hip-hop is having a moment. Authorities are trying to suppress it, but the raw power of the music may be unstoppable.
Hip-hop is a very interesting way of measuring political stamina in Egypt at this moment.
Young Egyptians push hip-hop to the limit, ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Spain is sweltering under record heat this week, like much of southern Europe. Temperatures in some areas have topped 110 degrees. But summer, of course, is also the best season for generating solar power. Europe has an ambitious goal to get 30% of its energy from renewables by 2030. And Spain's Andalusia region is doing its part to get there. In the past year alone, it's approved more than 1,000 green energy projects, mostly solar. But some locals worry that authorities are going too far. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from near the southern Spanish city of Granada.
Olive trees are everywhere in Andalusia. You can't miss them, with their silvery green leaves and twisted trunks. Some of these trees were planted more than 500 years ago, but tearing them out takes just minutes. How many trees can you rip out in a day? I yelled to a man operating a backhoe with big pinchers. We're out on a vast brown plain. 10, I say. More, the guy answers. 100. First you cut the limbs, he says, then the trunk, then you have to tear out the root system underground. The man, who doesn't want to give his name, is nimble on the controls, dicing up one olive tree like a chef on a carrot. A mile or so away, another guy with a maul smashes the leftover stumps into fireplace-sized logs. What remains is a pockmarked wasteland stretching for miles. But it's a necessary step, government officials say, as the region transitions to renewable energies. See, the trees are making way for a new sort of forest, of solar panels, projected to cover between 60 and 380 square miles of land. But in trying to avoid a climate catastrophe, some local farmers say the government is creating another disaster. On a recent day, olive farmer Jose Antonio Torres is out trying to jumpstart his old tractor. He tends to hundreds of acres of trees on the sun-baked hills surrounding his home. He says energy companies call him night and day, urging him to rent his land out for solar panels. He says he tells them no one is going to touch his olives.
Entonces sería un paraguas gigantesco.
I'd end up having something like a giant umbrella around my farm, he says. It'd be so ugly. I won't get on board, no matter how much money they offer. Even if it costs me the farm or my marriage, he says. My wife is very worried about our financial situation. Torres struggles to make ends meet these days. There's a drought, soaring fuel prices. To get by, he moonlights a few miles up the road, pumping gas. He says he's hanging in there, but he's scared. I suspect that they'll eventually just take my land under eminent domain, he says, and all the arguments I make in defense of my land will add up to nothing. Torres fears expropriation because it's happened to other people in the region to erect solar panels or high-tension towers to bring green energy onto the grid. An hour's drive away, another farmer, Victor Guzman, shows me what was meant to be his dream retirement, a 400-acre olive farm / nature reserve. There's a big tower on the land now, he says, walking up a hillside. The lines mess up the view, but the real problem, he says, is with the eagles. They come out in the evening to hunt rabbits. On a foggy day, they can crash into those wires. So far, we've only lost pigeons, he says, but it'll happen soon enough. The tower is about 80 feet tall and made of gray steel. It's wide around the base and holds six thick lines that loop across the fields. The government put it there, despite Guzman's protests, citing a critical infrastructure need. To make the platform, they tore out an olive tree that had been there since before Christopher Columbus set sail looking for India. It took them forever to break the tree's hold on the earth, Guzman says. And when the representative from the energy company came and saw it, he says, even she started crying. Activists say green energy and agriculture can coexist. Alberto Matarán is an urban planning expert with an NGO called Aliente. He says you just have to do a little planning.
Sí, sí, hay sitios donde se podrían poner, claro. Se podría producir utilizando solamente los tejados.
There's room for solar panels here, he says. They could be relegated to rooftops and to surface areas already occupied by infrastructure, like highways. Why are they insisting on the olive orchards, he asks. Authorities say adding to existing infrastructure is more costly and time-consuming, and that time is of the essence. So the pressure on landowners to transition to solar farms isn't abating. Jose Antonio Torres, the olive grower who also works at the gas station, says he's found a compromise, if an uncomfortable one. Back on his farm, he takes me to a piece of land about 17 acres with wheat planted on it. He doesn't look happy.
Y aquí sería la tierra esta, que son de tierra calma, sería lo que...
So this here, he says, this is what I'm willing to cede to the solar project, pointing to the open field. I'm signing on because otherwise I can't keep up with my bills, he says. But it does leave a bitter taste in my mouth. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Andalusia, Spain.
India took a big step toward joining a pretty exclusive club today.
Liftoff normal.
Here we have a majestic liftoff of LVM3.
That's the Chandrayaan 3 spacecraft taking off for the moon. Chandrayaan number 1 was a lunar orbiter. Chandrayaan 2 was a lander with an ambitious goal of exploring the lunar surface.
But unfortunately, there had a glitch in the landing system. So lander and rover could not be deployed on the lunar surface back in 2019.
A glitch scuttled that second India mission. Milaswamy Andurai is an Indian space scientist popularly known as the Moon Man of India. He says India learned some lessons from previous mishaps. For example, instead of a narrow target for a landing, Chandrayaan-3 has a large area where it can touch down on the lunar surface.
A 4.5 kilometer by 2.5 kilometer. So wherever it lands, it will be safe and secure.
And while the previous mission crashed on landing, the new vehicle is sturdier.
The four legs have been tested and retested. Even if at the last minute, if it falls from the higher height, with the increased velocity, three times of increased velocity of Chandrayaan-2, the system will not break.
Touchdown is expected on August 23rd or 24th. If successful, this mission will make India only the fourth after the Soviet Union, the U.S., and China to soft land a spacecraft on the moon. Andurai says India is not being driven by competitiveness. Rather, he sees a future in collaborating with other spacefaring nations.
I think we can do it in a cooperative mode. So even International Space Station coming into the moon as International Lunar Space Station, possibility exists where India also can play a meaningful role. Technically, we are ready to join with others in equal way.
Chandrayaan-3 on its way to the moon. Indians hope the third time's the charm. Walk the crowded streets of Cairo and Giza in Egypt, and you're bound to hear some mahraganat. Mahraganat is Egypt's homegrown hip-hop. The 2011 revolution there served as a catapult for free expression, and the rap and trap scenes benefited. But these days, mahraganat musicians are not allowed to perform in public venues. The government has banned the music on university campuses in Egypt. Still, the genre is finding a way to thrive. Egyptian journalist Yasmin El-Rashidi explores how and why in her new book, Laughter in the Dark, Egypt to the Tune of Change. For the latest installment in our series, Planet Hip Hop, my colleague Marco Werman spoke with Yasmin, who's based in Cairo.
Yasmin, tell us about the roots of mahraganat. Where did it all begin?
Mahraganat is inspired by American hip hop. It grew out of the deepest alleys in Cairo, in lesser privileged neighborhoods, where young people began to experiment with beats, sounds, and lyrics that were an expression of their socioeconomic realities.
So it was really kind of an expression of frustration. Before the 2011 revolution, we know a lot of feelings among the public were suppressed under Mubarak. And I'm wondering if you see mahraganat almost more of an attitude, a new approach to not self-censor, a generational shifting of gears even in Egypt.
Absolutely. I mean, hip-hop is a very interesting way of measuring political stamina in Egypt at this moment. And political stamina, I don't mean in terms of actually a political movement, but the will to speak out.
Here's one exponent of that shift, Marwan Pablo, first known as Dama. You call him one of Egypt's most popular and successful young rappers. All right, we're fading that music because midway through this track, there's an explosion of profanity in English, which is kind of remarkable because Marwan Pablo came off the street scene in Alexandria, I gather, which is an especially conservative part of Egypt, right?
Yeah, he comes from Alexandria. You know, one of the things that the revolution revealed to us was that Alexandria was sort of the breeding ground of the most ultra-Orthodox current of the Islamic movement, Salafism. It's part of what makes his rise so interesting is in this song, the little clip that you played, he's talking about drinking to forget. Drinking, obviously, referring to alcohol. It's really a pushing back against all the norms and expectations, against a history of conforming and of silence and of, you know, swallowing your words. And he speaks very freely about things that certainly my generation were raised to not speak about, you know, from drinking to relationships to even speaking about money.
Well, these days, as you've already alluded to, Yasmin, there's a lot of things to push back against. In recent years, Maraganat musicians have often run headlong into government censors. Things really came to a head at the start of 2020 when two singers played this song live at a stadium in Cairo. So this is Hassan Shakush and Omar Kamal. What is the name of the song and why did it stir up so much controversy?
The song is called Binta Girin, which means the neighbor's daughter. And they rap about being so preoccupied with the neighbor's daughter and needing to smoke and drink to sort of forget her. And it had been out for a while, but then it headlined at a concert in Cairo Stadium, where there were tens of thousands of audience members, and it was aired on TV with millions of viewers. And the next morning, we woke up and everyone was talking about the song. By singing those words in Cairo Stadium, which is where our official football team plays, officials go, it was almost like it was normalizing the talk of smoking hashish or drinking.
Right. I mean, it's a song that marked a turning point. Egyptian authorities made the musicians apologize, then released a sanitized version. And then authorities decided that all Maraganat musicians would need a license to sing. How did musicians and fans react?
On the one hand, of course, there was outrage because as soon as you begin to crack down on music in any form, you're cracking down on culture. On the other hand, of course, there was the big question of how on earth do you crack down on Maraganat or any kind of music when most music is streamed online.
So one other artist I want to focus on, Mohamed Ramadan. He's one of Egypt's highest paid performers. Here's his hit Tanti, released last year. The video is set in the casino of an Egyptian billionaire. So Mohamed Ramadan flaunts his phenomenal wealth here. In this video, he strides into the billionaire's casino with a loaded gun, like he owns the place. It's pretty gangster, and yet he's allowed to perform. I'm just wondering, how do Egyptian authorities square that circle?
It's a bit of a catch-22. Mohamed Ramadan's extremely popular. He's popular first as an actor. He made his name and his fame acting. He has reached a level of fame and fortune sort of like Jay-Z. And he is all about flaunting his private jet rides and his fleet of super expensive sports cars and his gold and watches. It's tricky because on the one hand, a lot of Egyptians see him as corrupting social norms and values. On the other hand, you know, one of his close friends, and he's constantly showing this off, is the Egyptian billionaire Naguib Sawiris, who is respected and liked. And you can't really stop him. You know, even if the music syndicate and the authorities want to crack down on Maraganat, there's nothing that they can really do with a personality like that. His wealth has afforded him privilege.
Yasmin, take us out with one more track. This is another rising international Maraganat star, Wegs. His song Ez El Arab, released with a video as part of the official soundtrack to the FIFA World Cup in Qatar last year. So I wanted us to hear Wegs because perhaps it tells us something about where Egypt's Maraganat scene is headed. Is this genre a voice for change, or is there a part of this community that's been co-opted by Sisi and his government and another that's firmly underground for the foreseeable future?
Wegs has exploded now onto the international scene. He's extremely talented and he's a really good role model. And I think he can raise this genre and this form to a new level where the government will not be able to touch it. What is interesting and important and powerful about Maraganat is that it gives voice to a generation that the government traditionally and historically has tried to silence. And somehow through this music, they are speaking out and they are expressing creativity and they're exploring a creativity. The key is how the government is going to give them opportunity with that. And I think that will define where this goes. When people say what happened to Egypt and what happened to the revolution and the revolution is dead, what happened to that energy? The energy is there. The energy is in this music scene and in these artists and what they're doing.
That was Yasmin Al-Rashidi speaking with the world's Marco Werman. Al-Rashidi's new book is called Laughter in the Dark, Egypt to the Tune of Change. We're bringing you global hip-hop stories all summer long. It's part of our series, Planet Hip-Hop. Check out the playlist we've put together, which includes music from Egypt and a lot of other places where hip-hop is bumping. It's on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. Wimbledon is one of sport's biggest stages, and the finals are this weekend on the tournament's iconic center court. It's been a tough road for the players to get there. The world's Bianca Hillier catches us up on what's been going on in London.
The biggest story at Wimbledon this year is probably the surprising rise of Ukraine's Elina Svitolina.
Svitolina, remember, it feels like she's playing not just for herself here. She's playing for her country.
Throughout the tournament, Svitolina has been vocal about her support of Ukraine against Russia's invasion. The unseeded athlete got into the tournament through a wild card entry after giving birth less than 9 months ago. So making it to Thursday's semifinal match was a big deal. She was up against another unseeded player, the Czech Republic's Markéta Vondrousova, who played brilliantly to take the first set. Svitolina came back fighting, but Vondrousova quickly secured her ticket to the finals.
Oh, well. My goodness. That was a well-played match.
Markéta Vondrousova is now the first unseeded woman to reach the Wimbledon finals since 1963. After the match, Elina Svitolina said she felt massive support from Ukraine throughout the tournament.
I got a lot of messages from different people. It's unbelievable that they been there with me all the way, and hopefully they continue.
The second women's semifinal was a very different match, with big names Aryna Sabalenka and Ons Jabeur both seeking redemption. Jabeur was looking for a win after falling short at Wimbledon last year. She was runner-up. And just last month, Sabalenka was knocked out of the French Open in the semifinals. From the start, Sabalenka came out fighting.
She never learned how to hit a rally ball. She never learned how to hit a neutral ball, Sabalenka. You know, it's all 100 miles per hour.
Sabalenka seemed to get better and better as the games went on. But in the second set, Jabeur rose to the occasion.
A miss gives Jabeur a set point. This turned quickly.
It did turn quickly, and the match stayed in Jabeur's favor. She won in the third set and is headed to tomorrow's finals. Ons Jabeur, who's known back home in Tunisia as the Minister of Happiness, could now become the first African woman to win a Grand Slam. On Sunday, Center Court will host the men's final match in the singles competition. In today's first semifinal, Italy's Jannik Sinner forced Serbia's Novak Djokovic into a tiebreak in the third set. Here's an understatement. Djokovic is tough to beat in these situations, and today was no exception. The seven-time Wimbledon champ will now look for his third straight trophy in the finals. After the match, he said he likes to think he's playing the best tennis of his life.
I feel 36 is a new 26, I guess. You know, it feels good. And
Novak Djokovic, ranked number 2 in the world, will go on to face world number 1, Carlos Alcaraz. The Spaniard beat Russia's Daniil Medvedev in this afternoon's semifinal match. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
And finally today, we're going to end this week with you on a positive note. Every once in a while, we take a step back from the news to highlight stories about people who show up for each other.
I just want to tell this story of someone that touched my heart.
so much in a way I can't ever forget.
That's Jessie Maseli in Abuja, Nigeria. She told a story of her teenage son, Oriba Ogini, who was accepted to study at a university in Reading, England, some 3,000 miles from home. Jessie dropped her son off at school in the UK and was consumed with worry.
He was just 17, first time being away from home. All the motherly concerns, what was he going to eat? How was he going to cope generally on his own for the first time? When I got to Reading, we settled him into the hostel and then we went to church. And I actually got up, introduced myself and said, look, I was bringing my son for the first time to the UK from Nigeria. And I'm sure from the way I spoke, my concerns must have shown. So after the church service, this wonderful lady just walked up to me, holds my hand in such a comforting manner and says, I'll take care of your son for you. Oh my God.
I think she was a bit surprised because I didn't know her. I haven't met her before. When a mother said, oh, I'm leaving my son behind, I felt sympathetic. I have children as well.
And immediately she introduced herself to my son. I took her number, she took his number, and then I left back to Nigeria.
This was just the first time I'm on my own and didn't really know anyone in Reading because it's a different culture to what I grew up with. I didn't really know British culture.
But I actually made a room for him in my house so that he would feel comfortable.
They would come see me over the weekends and cook for me as well, and give me loads of food to stock up and eat during the week. Any day I was free, she would invite me over to hers for a meal or with her kids as well. So yes, she was like my second mother, basically.
I've really enjoyed kindness from other people, people I don't know. And that was the reason I become the mother to the child.
They were really helpful. They were like selfless. They surrendered their weekends to take me around places. And I don't think I got the chance to be lonely because they were always one call away and kept calling me to check up on me to make sure I was fine.
Ruby was taking care of my son and she was also sending, calling me, reassuring me in Nigeria that your son is okay. She was taking care of both him and she was taking care of me.
Even now, every time I go back to Reading, I'm always stopping by to say hi to them just because it's left a long-lasting memory. Where I live now, there's a university. I always go out of my way to help international students who are new to the country, just help them settle, just giving back, basically. But it's just the importance of, I guess, being kind and being your brother's keeper, especially when you didn't have to.
It was such an act of kindness from somebody I've never known before. I've never known Ruby before. And she just walked up to me. I'll call her my angel and took care of my son and allayed all my fears.
That was Jessie Maseli along with Oriba Ogeni and Ruby Aka. They told their story to the World's Joy Hackle. Sound design by Robin Moore. Music by Blue Dot Sessions. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Be good to each other this weekend. From PRX.